Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
At Community Bank, we're more than a place to manage your money. We're your neighbors and trusted financial advisors. For decades, we've helped families, small businesses, and individuals achieve their dreams. We're dedicated to your success every step of the way. Community Bank, member FDIC.
It's time for True American Heroes, For the Record, with Jack Rutland. Another exclusive on Super Talk Mississippi 102.1 FM. Many of our heroes have taken their stories with them to the grave. But this show is about the stories and personal experiences of these veterans.
Welcome. It's an honor for me today to have Mr. David Gibson, who is no stranger to this community and to the folks around Lincoln, Lawrence County. David, thank you for coming in to visit with us.
Well, it's good to be here.
Well, David's from my generation, so I'm really excited to hear some of the stories because he is a Vietnam veteran. And served our country wearing the uniform of the United States Army during that conflict. And for 20 years, you were a full termer. You went the 20-year route and retired from the Army, correct?
Yes. After I did my first tour, and then I decided that's what I wanted to do for a living, so I reenlisted and stayed.
Okay. Well, that's awesome. But I want to give folks a little background on you, because it was really interesting, because when you said I asked where you were from and you said I'm from out in Oley, well, I knew exactly where you were talking about. So tell us a little bit of your childhood and growing up, your parents and your siblings, and to just give us a frame of reference as to who we're talking about.
I came from a very large farm family. I have 11 brothers and sisters.
Awesome.
My father was named Richard. My mother named Tira. We lived on the only hill between Nola and Fair River, and I went to school in Monticello, and and right out of high school, I went into the Army.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, you know, you were raised on a farm, and you were a country boy, and what drew you to the – did you have other family members or siblings in the military? What drew you to the Army?
I had a brother-in-law that was a – paratrooper. He retired a sergeant major, married my sister, and I thought he was the coolest thing going. So and he was a paratrooper. He was in the 82nd Airborne at the time, and so I decided that's what I wanted to do.
So was he in the military when he married your sister?
Yes, he was.
So you were around all that military stuff, that jargon, and the stories. So you were getting it fresh from him.
Yeah, you know, and seeing he had a car, and he would let me date in his car, so that's kind of what drew me to him.
Well, that's interesting. So you decided to, right out of high school, you decided to enlist in the Army, and you went to the Selective Service Board, or to the Recruitment Board, I guess to the Army Recruitment Center, and how did that process go? Do you remember where you went? Were you had to go to Jackson, or would you do that in Monticello or Brookhaven?
No, Brookhaven. They had a recruiting station down where the old White House Cafe used to be.
Oh, yeah.
And I went there and enlisted there. Hey, one story about my growing up, that all my buddies, I didn't go the second grade. We had a little old country school, and there wasn't but two people in the second grade. And so they just put me in the third, and I skipped the second grade. So every time my friends run across something I don't know, they'll say they taught that in the second grade.
So you graduated with 11 years of school.
Yes.
That's awesome. Okay, so you enlisted here in Brookhaven at the recruiting office and joined the Army. Did they give you any options about what year was that?
This is 1958, first part of 58, January 58.
Okay, so did they give you many options about where you would go or what you would do in the Army, or did they just say, let's go to boot camp?
No, since I joined Airborne Unassigned, you know, we only had two airborne divisions, mm-hmm. the 82nd and the 101st, mm-hmm. and so you had to go to one or the other if you were going airborne, so I knew I would be going to one place or the other.
So yeah. Did you really know what you were doing when you decided to get in airborne? I mean, those are those crazy guys that jump out of perfectly well-running and operating airplanes.
Well, yeah, but, you know, when you fly with some of these Air Force pilots, you know, it's a lot better to jump out of it and ride it, you know.
Well put. So, you did choose the airborne, and they let you go. So you went to jump school.
Yeah, I went through basic training, Fort Carson, Colorado, went mm-hmm. through AIT at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, mm-hmm. and I got assigned. Back then, you went to your unit and then went to airborne school out of your unit. So okay. I got assigned at a 504 Fort Bragg, and went to jump school at Fort Bragg. Now, since then, they've consolidated, and
correct.
Jump school is at Fort Benning now. I well know that because I worked there for several years. We'll get into that later.
Sure. So that's 101st Airborne.
Yes.
And so you went to you joined the 101st, and then they assigned your jump school to you. Tell us a little bit about
this. Was in the 82nd now to start with, not the 101st.
Oh, I'm sorry.
101st later on in Vietnam.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about jump school. What's that experience like?
About 3 weeks of torture, physical training, and of course, back then you had 1 week of nothing but physical training. They just ran you to death. Mm. Back then, you know, in peacetime, our service during peacetime, we gear down, and in wartime, we gear up. So it was geared down at the time. It was after Korea, you know, and all that. So they didn't care where you made it or not. You know,
gotcha.
And
so probably the training was intense to get you ready, but also to send you home if you weren't jump material.
That's right. You know, they want to weed out the ones that really don't want to be there. So,
gotcha. So all right. I'm a little bit familiar with jump schools. I've seen a little stuff on that and know a few guys. And so, you know, when they finally said you're ready to jump, do you remember that first jump?
Oh, yeah. You always remember your first jump.
Can you describe it to us? I mean, what were y'all jumping out of? What type of airplane was it then?
We were using C-130s and C-119s.
Okay.
The old C-119 is the one that has the double boom on the back.
That's right.
It Einstein said couldn't fly because
was that what they call the old box car, the old flying box car? Yeah.
Those
are antique. They don't even exist anymore.
That thing would sit on the runway and they'd rev it up. You could hear bolts rattling in it. And when they would take off, they would go out over the old division area if the wind was right. And I'll swear that you could almost step out onto the top of the buildings. They would just barely clear the building.
So
when they got phased out.
So your first jump, though, was, you remember how high y'all actually went?
1,250 feet. All your military training jumps 1,250 feet out of fixed wing and 1,500 feet out of helicopter.
Okay.
Takes a little longer for the chute to open out of a helicopter. That's the reason you go a little higher.
A little bit higher.
And that gives you time to activate your reserve if something goes wrong.
So how many troopers were on one plane back then, the old C-119?
Well, depends on the aircraft. Let me see, a C-130 held 64.
Right.
And
but the old boxcar was a lot smaller.
Yeah, seems like 27, 32, something like that.
And your first jump was on an old boxcar.
Yeah. Man, this was 50 years ago now.
That's right. Okay. So they get you up to altitude, and I'm sure your sergeant stands you up. Everybody checks parachutes.
Yeah, you have a jump master. I became one later on. You have a jump master that gives all the jump commands, and he stands you up and hooks you up and watches for the light and tells you when to go, and you go. And see, the first airplane that I ever went up in, I jumped out of it. So
that's the first time you'd ever flown.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the first time I'd ever flown. And they had a drainage ditch down the middle of the drop zone. It was there at Fort Bragg. And there was a bunch of weeds growing up and, you know, being from Nolan. I thought it was trees. And until I got down far enough to see that it was just tall weeds. But, yeah, jumped out of the first one.
So was it terrifying or was it fun or both?
Kind of both.
Okay.
You know, they have you where you're trained. You're trained up.
Prepared.
And you trust your equipment.
That's right.
But there's still some apprehension.
Sure.
There's still some apprehension.
Jumping out of a perfectly operating aircraft, that takes a little challenge. Do y'all pack your own parachutes?
No. They have a detachment that's all they do is pack parachutes.
Okay. All right. So you finished jump school, and what's your next assignment?
Well, shortly after I got out of jump school, I'm in the 504, and they had a program then where they would replace an entire unit in Germany with a unit. Mm-hmm. So I went to Germany
rotating.
With a 504.
Right.
We were in battle groups at that time, not battalions. So the two battle groups, 504, 505, went to Germany. I was in Mainz, Germany. The 505 was across the river in Wiesbaden. Everybody knows where Wiesbaden is, where the hospital is there.
Mm-hmm.
But
so how long? You were there how long?
2 years.
Two years.
It was 2 years unaccompanied tour. My wife did go over with me.
Awesome.
But I had to pay for it myself and all that, you know, so I only had to put in a 2-year tour over there.
Okay, so from Wiesbaden or from Germany, where were you assigned?
I came back to Fort Bragg to the 503rd. The notable thing that happened there is I'll just try to hit the highlights. That was when the Cuban Missile Crisis came along.
I remember that well, yeah.
And so I spent 24 miserable hours in a parachute at Eglin Air Force Base waiting to jump into a sugarcane field in Cuba.
So you jumped into Cuba?
No.
We were prepared to.
We were prepared to.
That's right. Hey, it didn't ever happen.
It didn't happen.
Thankfully.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. So what year was that? You remember, David?
Yeah, it had to be 60, right?
Something like that.
Yeah, it had to be 1960 because I came back, 60, the latter part of 1960.
Yeah.
After that, I applied for Ranger School and got accepted for Ranger training. And I went through Ranger training, and I was enlisted honor graduate of my Ranger class. So
awesome.
Right after that, they had a change or turnover in personnel, and they drafted me back into the Ranger Department as an instructor. And that's where I spent most of the rest of my career when I wasn't overseas fighting. I spent the rest of my career in the Ranger Department.
Okay. All right. Well, this is awesome. We're talking with David Gibson, retired United States Army, and we're going to be right back after this short break. Welcome back. Today, I'm honored to have with me Mr. David Gibson, who is no stranger to the Lincoln County, Lawrence County folks, raised out at Noli, and a veteran and a retired Army personnel and a veteran of Vietnam. And he's been telling us some neat stories about his experience in the service. We're leading up to the Vietnam conflict, but I want to hear a little bit more about you were an instructor, you were training after being trained as a paratrooper, part of the airborne. But tell us a little bit more. I think it's really neat the way you kind of went up through the ranks because you didn't have ROTC or anything like that in college. You worked your way up through the ranks. Isn't that right, David?
That's right. Now, I was in the Ranger Department. I had made SART first class, and Vietnam started revving up.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, small unit leaders are in high demand during combat time. And so my superiors encouraged me to go to OCS. I had qualifications to go to OCS.
And OCS is Officer Candidate School. Right.
So I went to Officer Candidate School, finished third in my class.
Awesome.
And I went from there, believe it or not, back to the Ranger Department, to the Florida camp as an instructor, and then went from there to Vietnam on my first tour of duty.
Okay, so what your rank out of OCS was second lieutenant?
Second lieutenant.
Okay, and then you get the notification that you're headed for Southeast Asia?
For Vietnam, yes.
Did you have an assignment at that time, or did you get there and then they assigned you? What happened in that process?
I had an assignment from the start, from the Department of the Army. I was Pathfinder qualified, and I went to, this was my first tour of duty, I went to the 1st Aviation Brigade in Pleiku as a Pathfinder Detachment Commander. I had a 20-man Pathfinder Detachment.
Okay. But back up. What's a Pathfinder? Explain that to the audience.
Pathfinder is really a field operating air traffic controller. They would insert us when they were going to make a combat, they call it a combat assault, where they take the helicopter, deliver the troops to the field. Mm-hmm. We would go in ahead of them, make sure it was secure. We weren't equipped to fight now. We would just go in and recon, make sure it was secure.
Okay, wait a minute, David. I got to back up. You weren't prepared to fight, but you were inserted ahead of the main group that was going to be coming in. What did they expect you to do? Just hide and watch? Is that what the Pathfinder was all about?
If they couldn't extract us with helicopters, we had to E&E, escape and evade, and get out of the area. We had to do that one time.
Oh, my goodness.
And I spent a night on a 8-inch artillery base, and I think that's where my hearing went bad.
My goodness. So Pathfinders actually went in ahead of a major of action.
Yes.
And you were like recon, but you were doing it from a distance, and you were able to – and you had how many men when you went in? How many were in the insertion?
Well, for each one, we would take about five with us. It's just a small group, five Whew. People. I had, you know, the 20 men that I had was four teams, and only one team would go in. But we had weapons to defend ourselves,
sure.
but we didn't have enough firepower.
Well, no,
to fight
no, that's
anybody,
right. You know, you were just there to kind of hide in the bushes and be the eyes.
That's it.
Of those that were coming behind you.
That's it.
Wow.
And then we would guide the aircraft in, you know, and do the air traffic control thing.
Wow. Okay. So, how long did you stay with the Pathfinders, the whole time, that first tour?
That whole year. There was a lot of interesting things happened, and that will be another time. We'll get into that another time. But,
well, tell me this. Now, you were talking about there was one time where you had the E&E.
Yeah.
So, can you tell us a little bit about that experience? What happened? How did you get cut off where you couldn't get out?
Well, we called it a hot LZ. It was hot, and we knew if we brought the aircraft in, they were going to get shot at. So we you know, I was pretty good at map reading, and they told me where the nearest friendly unit was, and we cut out and on foot and went there.
My goodness. How long did it take you to get out? A day or two?
2 days.
2 days.
2 days.
And you were...
We had food. We had rations with us.
But you were not sleeping in friendly territory. There was enemy probably not right up on you. They didn't know you were there. They would have been after you, but they were probably all in that area where you were. You just had to keep your eyes open.
You know, that's a funny thing about it. You get acclimatized to that, and you're not in constant fear. You know, you're apprehensive.
But, you know, that's a neat thought, but at the same time, you have extra responsibility now. You are responsible for other lives. You're an officer. These guys look to you to make decisions. That had to be a little bit of an extra burden to somewhat.
It's a heavy responsibility, knowing that the decisions that you make may cost somebody their life, or a decision you make may save somebody their life.
Yeah.
You know, but it's an often awesome responsibility that.
And I guess you go
carry.
Back to your training, don't you? I mean, they train you how to make good decisions, and you follow those training. And I guess on occasion you may have to follow a gut feeling, but your training is what you lean on.
Yes, and I was fortunate enough that I had been around long enough and had enough experience that I think it was easier on me than it was on some other people.
How old were you then, David?
Well, I was, I must have been 23 the first time I went to Vietnam, and because I was 25 the second time, and I was an old man in the company.
That's what I was about to say. You probably had a bunch of 18, 19, 20-year-olds that looked
were.
To you.
They all were.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, when I see the statue up in Washington, that's my first impression. Those people are too old.
Ah, good point. Good point. Yeah, I know the statue you're talking about. I've stood there by it. So, okay, let's wrap up this first tour, because I want to really get into this second tour, because this is where it's really, really interesting. The second tour, I mean, well, at the end of this first year, you rotate out, and you were back in the States for how long?
For 1 year.
1 year.
I went Fort Gordon, Georgia, basic training company, running basic trainers through 8-week cycles. And I did that for a year and then got orders to go back to Vietnam.
Okay, so now, though, you're going back not as a Pathfinder.
No, I'm going back as I didn't know what I was going to be when I left, but as it turned out, I was went back as a rifle company commander.
Rifle company commander. So that means you're right in the middle of everything. And I use this as an affectionate term. You were dealing with a bunch of grunts.
That's it. Well, ground pounders.
Ground pounders. That's right. The men who do
grenade
the fighting.
Chunkers.
The ones that do the fighting. So let's talk just a little bit about that tour, and then we're going to set the stage. We're going to actually do a third segment. So we'll set the stage for that. You get over there, and you're a first lieutenant by then, I think, or maybe a captain. Which
I had made captain by the time I got over there.
And I've heard this now. You may correct me, but I've heard that a life expectancy of a company commander in Vietnam was how long? I've heard it was just a few weeks.
I don't know the exact length, but it was short. I know this. I was the only one in my battalion that made it all the way through.
Good gracious.
The rest of them that were there with me, as a matter of fact, I evacuated a couple of them that got killed. A good friend, John Gay, got killed.
Mm. All right, so let's get this second tour started. You're in Vietnam now.
Okay.
And you're an infantry company commander.
Yes, I got assigned to the 501st in the 101st Airborne Division, 1st Battalion of 501st. I reported into my company to my battalion commander, Colonel Rogers, and he told me, says, I don't have a job for you right now, but
come back
tomorrow and we'll see. And that night they woke me up and said, Charlie Company commander got killed, said you're going out and taking over Charlie Company. So I went to the field the next morning. We were the first part of that tour, we were down in southern south of Way, and it was mostly dealing with VC transporting rice and all that. We were ambushing and doing that sort of thing. And then we moved from there out to the Ashau Valley. And, you know, the North Vietnamese, they were moving supplies down the Ho Chi Minh Trail,
right,
bringing it in through the Ashau Valley, and we were out there trying to disrupt that.
So how long would you stay in the field at one time? Did it vary depending on the assignment?
We lived in the field.
So you went out. That's what I'm trying to get. When you left friendly territory and went out in the field, how long would you stay?
I stayed out there 9 months. Out of 9 months, I spent maybe 3 nights back in a rear area. The rest of the time was in the field.
You were in a combat zone all this time.
Yeah. We and that's one thing a lot of people don't realize is the challenge of being a foot soldier is just taking care of everyday things, personal hygiene and food and all of that. And because you're living out of your rucksack, you know, you just throw it down and...
Well, I've often heard it said by old soldiers that the most important thing they carry is their socks, a change of socks, because their feet is how they move.
Yes. We would actually wear fatigues until they just came apart, and they would bring us in new, and we'd take and pile up the old ones, burn them, and put on the new ones. And
my goodness.
We probably smelled pretty bad, you know, because there wasn't much water. You had to take a bath and steel helmet and all that, you know.
So you were pretty much in the field this whole second tour. You were out in the jungle.
Out in the field. Now, the last couple of months, I came back in to S3 operation. You know, they sent a new commander out. Mm-hmm. I stayed out there 3 months longer than I was supposed to.
So we've got just a minute here, and we're going to end this segment, and we're going to come back. So a lot of engagements, I'm sure, a lot of firefights.
Yes.
You know, any of them stand out where you just thought, hey, we're in serious trouble? probably more than one, but any that just really stands out in your mind? Because you had how many men did you have?
150.
So you had a lot of guys you were responsible for. Any of those firefights really get, you weren't sure you were going to get out of it?
Well, yes, the one that we're going to talk about for where the guy got the Medal of Honor, that's when the rubber Metro Road. Okay. That's going to be real intense.
Well, that's one and the same. We'll talk about that in this next segment. We're actually doing, radio audience, I want you to know we're doing an extra segment to hear David share his experience. David was a company commander of a young man that he recommended for the Congressional Medal of Honor, our highest award for valor. And we want to hear that story. So we're going to invite you to come back and hear this third segment on the next program of True American Heroes for the Record. I'm honored to have with me Mr. David Gibson from right here in our own hometown. And we'll see you for that next segment in just a little while. Good morning. Welcome to True American Heroes for the Record. And today we're actually doing something just a little unusual. We're going to have a third segment with one of our local neighbors, Mr. David Gibson, who was a Vietnam veteran and served two tours in Vietnam and in the airborne as well as the Ranger unit. And David, we wanted to do this third section because you and I have talked some, and I'm just real impressed when you were telling me about some of the men in your unit, because it was a rifle unit, it was an infantry unit, and you were in the jungles the whole time you were over there that second tour, which was about a year, most of the total time you were there. But I wanted you to tell me a little bit about your daily operations and the men that you served with, because there's one in particular we're going to talk about, but I wanted you to have an opportunity to share this segment here this morning about those guys and what it was like to lead them, because you were the company commander.
Yes. For me, it was the greatest bunch of men that ever lived. Hmm. We were out in, I'll start out by telling you, we were out in the Ash Owl Valley, and I got a call to come in and be at a pickup point, and they picked us up and flew us up to Tam Key. Now, I had one of my platoon leaders 2 weeks ago passed away. His name is Dan O'Neill. He passed away up in Pennsylvania. I was unable to go to his funeral, but I participated in his funeral with some people that I knew. Mm-hmm. Had them to go in my place. I had Don Gurley was a platoon leader. Mm-hmm. Don Gurley came to me out of ROTC, and I've told Don this face-to-face, so he wasn't very good when he first came. He was overweight and out of shape.
And green.
And green and didn't know a whole lot. Turned out to be one of the finest platoon leaders the Army ever had. Mm-hmm. He did me proud later on, Dan O'Neill. Then my third platoon leader was a enlisted man. His name was Isaac Hayward, African-American, lives over in Columbia, South Carolina. I talked to him 3 or 4 days ago, as a matter of fact. He retired a sergeant major. Mm. He had his platoon. Every time they would send me a platoon leader, the first one didn't last but one day. Mm. The second one lasted 2 or 3 days, and I told the battalion commander, I said, I'm satisfied with Sergeant Hayward. Don't send me any more lieutenants. See, so he was my third platoon leader for the rest of the time over there.
That's awesome.
As fine a soldier as you ever wanted to meet. Hmm. He went on and, like I said, became a sergeant major, retired sergeant major. And we stay in touch. I had people from all over North Carolina, South Carolina. The one Jesse Vera, he was from San Antonio, Texas. Tex Laraway was from San Antonio, and every time I talk to Tex, I laugh about. I don't know if you remember the movie Forrest Gump.
Oh yeah,
you know, he said he had a guy from Texas. I don't know where he was from. Or they had a man we called Tex.
Called Tex. We don't know where he was from.
We don't
That's
know
right.
where he was from.
That's right.
So we had Tex Laraway.
But he was from Texas.
He was from San Antonio, Texas.
Yeah.
McClendon from South Carolina, Perkins from South Carolina. We have a web page. We stay in touch. And
David, it's obvious you get close to these guys, and especially when you think about it, I can remember, I was never in combat, but I remember in some sporting teams where you have to really work hard and dedicate yourself, you get close to those guys. I can only imagine what it's like in a combat setting. You just like brothers. Really, it is truly a band of brothers.
Yes, it is. And see, and that relationship between men and commanders. Now, every one of them would tell you I was tough. I was tough on them because I was trying to keep them alive. And after it was all over, they understood that. They realized that and appreciated it after it was all over. I wasn't friends with them then. I was their commander, but I'm friends with them now.
All right, that's a great point. But I want us to get into, because I want to have plenty of time to talk about some of these engagements, especially the one where you had the young man who won the Medal of Honor. I guess we need to start with that, so we'll be sure to have plenty of time.
Okay.
Tell us about what led up to this event, this engagement that led to this young man being awarded this incredible honor.
Okay, I'll go through it as best as I remember. We were out in Ashau Valley. They called and they flew us up to Tamkee. The AmeriCal division was in trouble. The NVA, now, prior to this time,
that's right,
all my engagements had been with the Viet Cong,
VC. Right.
Now we're going to deal with the NVA.
NVA Army. Regulars, that's right.
Yeah, North Vietnamese Army.
Right.
Regular Army. So they flew us up there. They had ordnance up there where you could get new weapons. If you wasn't satisfied with your weapon, you could just pick you up a new one. It, radios, all of that. They even had personnel there so you could change your last wheel if you wanted it. Now, you're talking about a confidence builder. That's a confidence builder.
Mm.
But then we – and they had ice cream and Coca-Cola.
Good grief.
But I had to go to a briefing, so I missed out on the ice cream and Coca-Cola, and that's been a regret all my life. We got our orders, and we made a – and our mission was – there was three companies, A, B, and C company. I was Charlie Company. I was in the middle. And we were going to go out to a firebase professional and give them some relief. They had completely encircled that firebase, dug in, made concrete bunkers, all of that.
The
North Vietnamese Army.
Okay, so this firebase you're going to is already totally surrounded.
It's surrounded.
So you're probably going into a hot LZ to begin with.
Oh, yes, it was hot.
Go ahead.
We made our combat assault into the LZ. When we hit the LZ, made enemy contact immediately. They fired on us. We returned fire, and then they withdrew. So we didn't have any further incident that day, spent that night. And the next day, we were taking resupply, and I had a procedure that I'd go through when I'd take resupply to make sure the area was secure. Sergeant Hayward took his platoon. Jesse Rivera was in his platoon, by the way, and they went around to check the area out. We were down taking, and we caught an outpost eyeballing us from up on the ridge, and they came up behind them, killed seven or eight. And we took our resupply, and you always want to set up on high ground when you can.
Sure.
You want the high ground advantage. So we went up on Hill 187. And dug in. And I remember the men griping a little bit about having to dig in because it's real rocky. But I knew that the situation we were in, we needed to get ready. So after we got dug in, settled in, I got the platoon leaders, platoon sergeants up, and we'd always have a little meeting, you know, to make sure that everybody knew what was going to take place during the night so we could defend ourselves. And while we were in that meeting, and this gong rang down in the valley, and I said, what in the blank was that? And one of the sergeants had been over there in the first cab. He said, that's the way they signaled an attack when I was in the cab. So I said, everybody get back to their position. They got back to the position, and here they came.
Wow.
They started mortaring us, and we was taking—
What time? Is this middle of the night or early evening?
This is early evening.
Okay.
It's just right at dusk dark.
Okay.
So they started mortaring us, but their mortars wasn't very accurate. And then they came at us with a ground attack.
Yeah.
Well, we successfully beat them back there without— – we didn't take any casualties. And so they went back down the hill and reorganized, and here they came again. Well, this time they got two people— – got through our perimeter. We killed them inside the perimeter. And we beat them back again that time. And I got on the radio and called battalion. I said, hey, we're going to need some help. We're running low of ammunition. I don't think we can survive the night. So they sent us up a puff I don't know if you're familiar, it's a C-130 loaded with
weapons.
With the whole cargo space is ammunition, and it's loaded with miniguns.
Puff the Magic Dragons, what we used to call them.
Their claim to fame is one burst, they'll put a round in every square foot of a football field. Mm-hmm. So that puff flew, a couple of them relieved one another and flew above us all night and kept us up. They tried two more times for an attack, but it puff put a quick end to that.
Wow.
So we survived the night, and there was the next, we were going to move out the next day, but we had got a little ahead of the other two companies, and the battalion commander told me to stay there another day, another night, and we hadn't properly disposed, and it kind of got a little rank. Now, the next morning, I said, we got to leave, so we left, and we went on, and we spent the next night, and then the next day, which was the 31st of May, my point stopped, and they called me up front, and I could look across, and you could see the enemy across. We were on high ground. It was about a 100-yard rice paddy. This was the terrain up there was Vietnam is a lot like the United States. You got the northern part, the central part, and the southern
different
part.
Different terrains.
And this was kind of the foothills, and the rice paddies up there were usually small and just individual farmers, for their own use. So it had about a 100-yard rice paddy, and then it went up on a ridge, and I could see them on the ridge up there. In the meantime, B Company had a platoon coming down that ridge, and they engaged in a firefight, and then they lost communications with that platoon. Battalion commander called me and told me, "Say you need to attack." And I said, "You want me to attack with no artillery support, no air support?" And he said, "Well, we don't know what those people's circumstance is from B Company that's in there." Said, "You need to attack." So I called my platoon leaders and platoon sergeants in. I said, "We need to come up with a plan of attack." And this is, I credit all my ranger experience to this. And we came up with an attack plan. And basically, I took my six machine guns and put them on higher ground. And they were going to give us cover while we crossed the rice paddy. So we, set up our time, got all that coordinated, and we got down with myself and the rest of the platoon, put the machine guns up there, gave the signal, they cut loose, and they kept them pinned. I remember telling the platoon leaders and the platoon sergeant, I said, "Look, when we start across that rice paddy, we got to go." I said, "We can't let them stop us in that rice paddy. If they stop us, that's going to be the end of us." And so it worked out. And they kept them pinned. We got across the rice paddy. I think we lost two people in the rice paddy, and there was a rock wall on the other side, and we climbed the rock wall. Well, an infantry unit, you have platoons and squads, and what you do once you get in there is use fire, what we call fire and movement. One group lays down a base of fire, one group moves, So that's what we did. We got on the wall. I remember going up the wall. An RPG went by my head. Mm-hmm. I remember it exploded out into the rice paddy out there. But when we got onto the wall, we used fire and movement. It was kind of thickly vegetated in there.
Yeah.
And we started easing forward. And this is when the fire team that Jesse Avera was in, his there's five men in a fire team. Two of them got killed. One of them got wounded. And Jesse picked up one of the other rifles, got all the grenades from those, and he started on a personal vendetta going from bunker to bunker. And he knocked out six by himself.
Goodness.
With grenades. And, Don Gurley put it, we weren't hand-to-hand, but we were hand grenades and rifles at about 10 meters.
Good gracious.
And he said, it's spitting distance. And we successfully took that ridge. We accomplished our mission and took that ridge.
Did Jesse survive?
Jesse didn't get a scratch. I didn't get a scratch. One jumped up out of a spider hole and fired at me and hit my fatigue pants, but he didn't hit me. So then
you recommended Jesse for the Medal of Honor?
Well, two or three days later now.
Oh, sure.
During periods like that, the last thing on your mind is awards.
But as you reflected.
Yeah, you reflect back on what happened and everything. And Don Gurley came and said, hey, did you see what he did? I said, I saw part of it because one of the bunkers that he knocked out was right in front of me, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we got together and found out that, you know, that he had – just done it on his own. And talking to him later on, he said, well, it was either to lay there and take it or give it everything I had. So he gave it everything he had. And so Don wrote up the citation, and of course I concurred, and the battalion commander concurred, and he got awarded the Medal of Honor.
Did he survive Vietnam?
Yes, he did. He passed away about a year ago.
Wonderful.
He worked for the post office in San Antonio, Texas, and he passed away about a year ago. As a matter of fact, he was supposed to come over to see me.
To see you.
Yeah, but he had heart trouble and he passed away.
Wow, that is just taking my breath. And I know we're about out of time, so I'm going to wrap this up. David, I can't tell you what an honor it's been to have you here. David, who was a Vietnam veteran, two tours, Pathfinder, airborne, but the last tour was company commander of a group of fighting men, and one of his men showed extraordinary heroism and was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor, our country's highest award. David, I want to say thank you for your service. I am honored to know you. I think what you did serving and leading those men, like you said, your goal was to do your job and get them out of there safely. I thank you for your service to your country. I thank you for what you did during that time when your country needed you. And it's been an honor to have you here with us today.
It's been an honor to be here. And I wanted to say that Senator Doty does a great job out there, and along with you, Jack, in honoring the veterans. And I've been to some others that didn't do that, and I appreciate that. And the next time that you're at one of these and they introduce the old grunt, the guy that got drafted, give him an extra round of applause.
Absolutely.
They're my heroes.
Absolutely. David, thank you. It's been an honor to have you, and this concludes our program.
A Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.